This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. It's 4 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 6 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Coming up on today's programme, as the UK Parliament dissolves officially in advance of June's general election, wranglings over Brexit negotiations continue at a pace. Today's main issue was the so-called Brexit divorce bill, which EU negotiators have made a red line before discussions can even begin. More than 70 years after the end of the Second World War, and German society is still struggling to come to terms with what it means to be German. But will a new government plan help or hinder efforts to define German national identity? Following Pope Francis's visit to Cairo last week in an effort to mend ties with Islam, we'll be asking what this means for Christian communities in the Middle East and to what extent Christians feel protected by their faith leaders. US immigration officials have recommended more than 50,000 Haitians temporarily living in the US should be deported home, despite the country still recovering from a series of natural and man-made disasters. So will the move add even more misery to the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere? And the UK Labour Party has taken the term grassroots campaigning very literally, with some campaign grass cutting. Find out more at the end of the show. All of that and more over the next hour on this Wednesday edition of World in Focus.
I have just been to Buckingham Palace for an audience with Her Majesty the Queen to mark the dissolution of this Parliament. The 2015 Parliament is now at an end, and in 36 days, the country will elect a new government and choose the next Prime Minister. The choice you now face is all about the future. Whoever wins on the 8th of June will face one overriding task: to get the best possible deal for this United Kingdom from Brexit. And in the last few days, we have seen just how tough these talks are likely to be. Britain's negotiating position in Europe has been misrepresented in the continental press. The European Commission's negotiating stance has hardened. Threats against Britain have been issued by European politicians and officials. All of these acts have been deliberately timed to affect the result of the general election that will take place on the 8th of June. By contrast, I made clear in my letter to the President of the European Council invoking Article 50 last month that, in leaving the European Union, Britain means no harm to our friends and allies on the continent. We continue to believe that no deal is better for Britain than a bad deal, but we want a deal. We want a deep and special partnership with the European Union, and we want the EU to succeed. But the events of the last few days have shown that whatever our wishes and however reasonable the positions of Europe's other leaders, there are some in Brussels who do not want these talks to succeed, who do not want Britain to prosper. So now, more than ever, we need to be led by a Prime Minister and a government that is strong and stable. Because making Brexit a success is central to our national interest. And it is central to your own security and prosperity.
That was the UK Prime Minister Theresa May speaking about 15 minutes ago outside of Downing Street in London after she left Buckingham Palace, where she met with the Queen following the official dissolving of Parliament ahead of the snap general election scheduled for June 8th. This comes on the same day that battle lines continue to be carved over the question of a so-called Brexit divorce bill, and we heard Theresa May alluding to those disagreements there. For more on those clashes between the UK and the EU, here's Jack Foster.
In Britain right now, there's a lot of talk about Brexit and the planned withdrawal from the European Union. But in some respects, you'd be forgiven for thinking the entire thing had been put on hold, given the snap general election called by the Prime Minister last month. But despite the campaign rhetoric and the assumption that negotiations can only begin in earnest once a new UK government has been elected on June 8th, the Brexit clock is ticking and battle lines are very much being drawn. In the past week alone, details of a private meeting between between Theresa May and Jean-Claude Juncker in London leaked through the German press, revealing some unnerving observations which, if true, raise serious questions about the UK Prime Minister's experience and ability to facilitate negotiations. Those reports, however, have been dismissed variously as tittle-tattle, Brussels gossip and mere pre-negotiation spin by the UK government. UK Prime Minister Theresa May speaking on the election campaign trail this week.
I have to say that from what I've seen of this account, I think it's Brussels gossip. And just look at what the European Commission themselves said immediately after the dinner took place, which was that the talks had been constructive. But it also shows that actually these negotiations are at times going to be tough. And in order to get the best deal for Britain, we need to ensure we've got that strong and stable leadership into those negotiations. As I say, every vote for me and my team will strengthen my hand in those negotiations. And when it comes to June the 8th, people have a clear choice. There'll be 27 European countries on one side of the table. Who do they want to see standing up for Britain on the other side? Me or Jeremy Corbyn?
UK Prime Minister Theresa May responding to questions on Brexit talks this week whilst on the election campaign trail. Speaking this morning in Brussels, the European Union's chief Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, appeared to defend Ms. May and her team, saying that his experience of the discussions so far revealed an understanding of the complexities of Brexit from negotiators in London. He also said that he saw the snap general election as a positive element in the process. Given the complex nature of negotiations, the stability of a government in place for a full 5 years would help negotiations and not hinder them. On the subject of the so-called exit fee, that's the sum of money the UK would be required to pay the EU on leaving, Mr. Barnier was at pains to stress that there was no desire for the UK to write any blank cheques, as some critics have insinuated, adding that leaving the European Union did not come at a price. Rather, there were simply existing commitments that the UK would need to honour. The marginal right-wing pro-Brexit party UKIP's leader, Paul Nuttall, was true to form at a London campaign event this morning, during which he raised that so-called exit fee.
It's clear from the shenanigans over the past few days that the European Commission believes that this government can be pushed around. They also believe that the British people should be punished for Brexit and forced to pay a ridiculous divorce bill. This bill has risen from £50 billion to £100 billion in just a few days. What we want to know in UKIP is how much is the government willing to pay? As far as UKIP is concerned, we should not be paying anything at all. We believe the Prime Minister must make it clear to the Eurocrats that she is prepared to walk away, because if she does not, they will walk all over her and Britain will get a rotten deal.
Paul Nuttall, leader of the right-wing pro-Brexit UK Independence Party, speaking at a campaign event in London this morning. And on that issue of how much the UK government would be prepared to pay on exiting the EU, the government's Brexit secretary, David Davis, was asked just that at a Conservative election campaign event today.
The public want one thing. They want a good outcome for this negotiation. They want the best possible outcome for the negotiation. They don't want us to talk about a good outcome, they want the best outcome. And so we will be undertaking this negotiation in the negotiating room with Michel Barnier, Jean-Claude Juncker and the 27, and we'll be aiming to deliver a comprehensive free trade agreement, the sorting out of the European citizens' rights and British citizens' rights abroad, and we will certainly also be seeking to solve all the other measures related to justice and home affairs. We do that in the negotiating room, not by negotiating with a megaphone.
The UK government's Brexit secretary, David Davis, responding to questions on the so-called exit fee associated with Brexit at a Conservative Party campaign event this morning. He was also asked about that now infamous dinner attended by Theresa May and Jean-Claude Juncker, at which he too was also present, but specifically on that comment that Juncker made, saying that he was leaving Downing Street, quote, 10 times more sceptical than he was before.
We don't comment on private meetings, never have, never will, and there'll be many more private meetings between now and the end of 2 years. What I will say to you is the morning after, both Downing Street and the Commission said it'd been a constructive meeting. Of course there'll be differences of view. There'll be many of those over the coming couple of years. Don't be surprised, but we will resolve them. Jonathan.
On the number, I don't recognise this number. I genuinely don't recognise it. And look, it's moved by 60% in the space of a few days. It is just a negotiating position. What we do know is that we are on the brink of a very tough, complex, lengthy negotiation. And I'm not remotely surprised that people are manoeuvring for opening advantage in that negotiation.
The UK Chancellor of the Exchequer, Philip Hammond, and before that, Brexit Secretary David Davis, responding to questions from journalists on the so-called EU exit fee facing Britain on exiting the Union. And David Davis at that same event was also keen to press the point that the terms of Brexit negotiations are the responsibility of two sides and that Brussels was not in sole charge of the rules.
We're not entering this negotiation as a supplicant. It's not for the other side to lay down every single rule. And within the laws and rules of the European Union, we are a full member until the day we leave. We pay our full sub until the day we leave. We obey the laws until the day we leave. And the Prime Minister of this country is a member of the Council. So she will be seeing those, the people who are going to make the eventual decision on a monthly basis or more. Similarly, we will decide the structure of our negotiating team, not the European Union.
UK Government Brexit Secretary David Davis speaking in London this morning. And of course, by definition, all negotiations do have two sides. But it's important to remember that on one side of this particular negotiation, there are 27 countries. And on the other, well, there's just one. And so even the most optimistic Brexiteer would do well to exercise a little expectation management with regards to the possibility of the UK having an equal say in these negotiations. And that is really the nub of the whole debate. Just how possible it will be for the UK to influence the final settlement to the extent that it leaves with a good deal. And that's the dividing line in British politics right now. Those who believe that no deal is better than a bad deal, and those who don't. It's perhaps appropriate to return to the words of the EU's chief Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, who this morning talked in Brussels about his shared passion with the UK Prime Minister Theresa May for hill walking. And it was that shared passion that he used as an analogy for fruitful negotiations on Brexit. In negotiating rocky paths, one must place one foot in front of the other, keep breathing, maintain stamina, and never take your eye from the summit. Jack Foster, World in Focus.
And Jack Foster joins me in the studio now.
I'm not sure I agree with Michel Barnier about keeping an eye on the summit. I think you've got to keep an eye on the path as well.
Well, absolutely.
And the summit keeps disappearing, and you always think it's the summit, and then, of course, it's not the summit.
Well, you and I climbed a hill before and fallen victim to that, Jack, actually. I remember it well. Anyway.
We're not cycling up a hill.
Well, we've done that as well. Anyway, on to the Brexit chat there that you've just had that lovely report on. You talked a lot there, Jack, about this so-called exit bill. We've also heard it referred to as a divorce bill. And it's obviously shaping up as a pretty contentious opener for the Brexit negotiations. So just what exactly is it?
Well, this EU divorce bill, basically the UK currently makes annual contributions to the EU budget, as I'm sure most people would imagine. Those will stop when the UK leaves. Although Prime Minister Theresa May has said that the government is willing to make what she terms appropriate payments to the EU for participation in specific programmes. Quite what those payments might be and which EU programmes the UK would want to participate in still need to be agreed. The important thing is that this whole issue of a divorce bill does need to be agreed upon before any real negotiations begin, or at least that is the position from the EU side at the moment.
And why exactly does the UK potentially face this divorce bill on leaving the EU?
Well, I mean, following on from what I've just said there, I mean, the EU has assets and liabilities, as you would imagine. When the UK leaves, the UK will be expected to pay off its share of those liabilities. Now, it's worth noting that this divorce bill will also be reduced, whatever it would come to when that negotiation can actually take place. It will be reduced from any repayments to the UK. It does work both ways. But obviously, given the fact that there are 27 countries and the UK is the one that's leaving, the UK doesn't have a stronger hand in this.
It does sound like the actual figures that are being bandied around vary quite a bit. So why is that?
Let me try to run through those for you, Carolyn. In November of last year, the European Commission was reportedly looking for an exit bill of 60 billion euros. Now, in February of this year, the Centre for European Reform, CER, estimated that the bill could range from 25 to 73 billion. So still within the same ballpark, but the 25 billion figure is based on honouring commitments based made in annual budgets, maximising UK receipts, the 73 billion maximum obligations, minimum receipts. Essentially, Britain's financial obligations to the EU covers three main areas. Those are outstanding budget commitments, the EU officials' pensions, which is all kind of tied into being a part of the EU. Obviously, that has to be paid for, and contingent liabilities. That might include, for example, EU loans that potentially get defaulted on and anything like that, which has occurred whilst the UK was inside the EU, the UK would technically still be responsible for, regardless of their future status vis-a-vis being inside of the EU.
Now, what are the odds that the UK could simply refuse to pay?
Well, strictly speaking and legally speaking, this is difficult to predict. In the event that negotiations fail and it were to go to the International Court, there is not actually much certainty on how that would go. The UK House of Lords EU Financial Affairs Committee has said that the strictly legal case, in inverted commas, for the UK is strong. Although, of course, there's a lot more at stake in these negotiations than this one issue. And for that reason, technicalities and legal arguments are unlikely to be the thing that wins the day. This is much more likely to come down to politics. And thus far, it's been presented not just as a red line, but a red line to even get talks started.
I suppose the next logical question would be, has the UK government made any provisions for a divorce payment?
In a word, no. The OBR has only said that savings on EU contributions post-Brexit would be funnelled back into UK public expenditure, but no plans appear to be in place at all for exit payments.
And does the UK government have an official position on whether or not to pay any sort of divorce bill?
Well, the Brexit white paper from March, which would be your best clue to that kind of thing, didn't mention any exit payments. We could read into that what we may. Effectively, all we can do is take our cues from public statements which have been made by government ministers. For example, Liam Fox, the Secretary of State for International Trade, and Boris Johnson, Foreign Secretary, have both publicly dismissed the notion of paying any sort of EU divorce bill. Words such as absurd and unreasonable have been used when talking about it. The Prime Minister, Theresa May, said at the EU Spring Summit, and I quote, "When people voted to leave the European Union, they voted for us in the future, not paying huge sums of money into the EU every year. Of course, when we leave the EU, that will be the case." Now, of course, that's not a particularly explicit statement from the Prime Minister. She's simply saying that huge sums of money won't be getting paid into the EU every year from now on. That could still leave her the wriggle room to say that we would pay a divorce bill in the event that that came up. But given that it's become such a strong negotiating position, strong isn't the word I'm looking for, a deeply entrenched negotiating position, my apologies there, it's difficult to see where it would go, but she has backed herself into a corner now where if she does turn around on this, and it looks like she probably will have to, the UK government isn't going to be able to set the tone on this without having to go to the International Court, it's probably going to look like a pretty horrific U-turn.
Though we now will probably have to wait until after the 8th of June to get any firm statement on that.
Yes, as we saw, the Prime Minister dissolved Parliament today and went to visit the Queen in Buckingham Palace. I shall not join the coverage that was given by some other broadcasters, which did languish a little too long, I think, on helicopter shots of Buckingham Palace and speculation as to what that private conversation might have involved. Who can possibly say?
Who can say? Well, thank you very much once again, Jack Foster.
Pleasure, Carolyn.
We are above all the latest developments, and we don't take any sides. Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, more than 70 years after the end of the Second World War, and German society is still struggling to come to terms with what it means to be German. But will a new government plan help or hinder efforts to define the German national identity? We'll have more on that in just a few minutes.
Radio Sputnik. Brave New World.
For many of us, online shopping is already part of our ordinary lives. Why go out when you can sit on the sofa and order online? Shopping malls are apparently feeling the effect of this, and many are closing. Retail is evolving. To find out more, listen to Brave New World.
What are we to make of Trump's first 100 days in office? A president who entered the White House promising to roll back from years of disastrous foreign wars and military interventions ended this all-important initial period in power as one of the most hawkish and interventionist US presidents of modern times. And if this is the first 100 days, what can the world expect in the next 100 days of the Trump administration? Join me, John White, for the next episode of Hard Facts.
From June 1st to June 3rd, political leaders, top experts, and prominent businessmen from all across the globe are meeting at St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. Join them in discussion on relevant topics concerning new economic reality, geopolitics to cybersecurity, roughly 100 business events, roundtables and discussions, business breakfasts, and insightful lectures, all this and more at SPIEF 2017. Don't miss out. More details on forumsbb.com.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at sputniknews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, more than 70 years after the end of the Second World War, and German society is still struggling to come to terms with what it means to be German. But will a new government's plan help or hinder efforts to define German national identity? Following Pope Francis' visit to Cairo last week in an effort to mend ties with Islam, we'll be asking what this means for Christian communities in the Middle East and to what extent Christians feel protected by their faith leaders. And the UK Labour Party has taken the term grassroots campaigning very literally with some campaign grass cutting. Find out more at the end of the show. It's 72 years since the end of the Second World War and the defeat of Nazi Germany, but the question of what constitutes German national identity remains a deeply controversial one. This week, the German government announced a new plan setting out what it thinks German identity means. Our reporter Mark Hurst picks up this story.
The German government has set out a new plan this week to redefine what it means to be German, but its opening statement makes it clear what German ministers believe does not constitute the country's national identity. Wir sind nicht Bürger. We are not Bürger was the opening statement of a 10-point proposal that seeks to define German national identity. The subject remains a highly controversial one for German society, still sensitive about associations with the Nazis and their specific vision of what constituted German identity. But recent tensions focused on the issue of immigration, combined with growing concern over Islamic-inspired terrorism, have reignited a debate that has existed in Germany since the end of the Second World War. Critics of the move have described the proposals as counterproductive, with others suggesting German ministers are launching the plan in an attempt to recapture much of the political ground lost to right-wing parties who are using fears over immigration for their own agendas. So is the German government right to raise this debate now, and has it set the correct tone? Well, on the line now is Dr. Patricia Hogwood from the Department of Politics and International Relations at the University of Westminster. Dr. Hogwood, how much of a shadow does the actions of the Nazis still cast over the question of modern German identity, and how difficult a challenge does that past pose for present-day efforts by the German government to promote a new positive collective identity for Germans today?
It still casts a considerable shadow over German politics. You see it in various branches of policy, for example, in defence strategies. The Germans are still very uncomfortable about the idea that their forces might be used overseas, for example, just in case they get drawn into offensive actions rather than peacekeeping types of action. You see it at many, many levels. I would say I think this is a generational problem, and it's also more of a problem for Western Germans than Eastern Germans. But since the majority of the political representatives in Germany are made up of Western older people. These people have still got very direct connections with the idea that they have to apologize for being German. They're very aware of the atrocities committed by the Nazis, and they want very strongly to differentiate themselves from the Nazis. And for younger people, it's not such a problem. Certainly since German unification, we've seen a new generation grow up with no memories, even through conversation with their families, no direct memories of the Nazi period. They don't want to be tarred with that brush. Our young people, they can say, you know, what has it to do with us? It's not really something that they identify with.
Do they understand the sensitivities around the issue of, you know, this Nazi past?
They certainly do, because they're taught it very actively in school. You know, there's still a very strong educational program in schools that educates people away from right-wing extremism. This is why in Germany it's such a shock that a party like the Alternative for Germany has emerged, which is not a Nazi party, it must be said. It's a legal party. It campaigns perfectly legally, but it expresses far more racist and right-wing views than would have been tolerated in the past. In fact, Germany was the last of the European countries to develop a party like this, precisely because of the education that they receive in schools. I also said it was a Western problem rather than an Eastern problem. This is because in West Germany, there was this culture of this idea that the Germans needed to rehabilitate themselves.
Denazification. Exactly.
It was a program that went on for many years and carried on by successive governments and presidents, called Overcoming the Past. And it's played a very strong role in the public intellectual development of Germany, of West Germany. So West Germany took responsibility for the actions of the Nazis and tried to rehabilitate themselves on many levels, including this idea that they wanted to create a new German identity that distinguished itself from this Nazi taint. On the other hand, the East Germans, the ones that grew up in the German Democratic Republic, they were taught that as workers, because it was a workers' state, they also were victims of the Nazis, and so they had nothing to apologize for. So there's a very different attitude towards the Nazi past between older Germans from the West and older Germans from the East.
And is there a risk that if the German government impose its own definition and rules about what constitutes German culture and identity, that it simply alienates further immigrant groups who may strongly feel German but who also observe their own cultures and customs and incorporate those into their everyday lives?
Yes, it is. It is a danger. There's a danger that the government has jumped the gun on this a little bit, because as they point out themselves, you know, there aren't really significant numbers of women who wear the burqa or the niqab in public service and in public life. You know, it's not really an issue at the moment. So, you know, you could say that perhaps they're creating divisions where that there don't need to be any. But on the other hand, they are very aware, the governing party of the government coalition as it is at the moment, the CDU-CSU party, are very aware of the advances of the Alternative for Germany, which is the more radical right-wing party. Many of their voters, their core voters, particularly older voters, particularly those in the state of Bavaria that vote for the CSU, these are they're more reactionary than the general public. They're more right-leaning than the general public when it comes to immigration and asylum issues, anything to do with citizenship. You know, they're very, very proud of German citizenship and suspicious of foreign incomers. The party will be very aware that they mustn't let the AfD skim off the voters on the periphery of their core voters. So this is really why they're doing it at the moment, I think. Also, it's been launched in the form of an interview with the press, rather than as a policy statement. And everybody understands it is a policy statement in effect, because it's in the context of the election campaign. But, you know, it has been presented more as an interview than as a policy document. And Thomas de Maizière, the Home Minister who made this statement, he did take pains to state that, you know, that this was not a definitive set of lists. It wasn't sanctionable. It wasn't going to be imposed on anybody. But so you're right to say that, you know, it can and has in fact caused a lot of controversy. But at the same time, for strategic reasons to do with the electoral campaign, you can see why the party's done this at the moment.
And you mentioned the German Interior Minister there. He's described religion as the glue that binds German society. But it's clear that for many people, religion is also seen as the aspect that's dividing people, not just in Germany, but across Europe. Is the German government right to focus on religion as one of the key defining aspects of German identity? And what risks does that focus bring to the wider debate about national identity?
If you have access to the actual statement that was made, actually the Birka statement and the religion statement were very small parts of this proposal overall. You know, what the Interior Minister was trying to focus on was constitutional patriotism. You know, we value our constitutional democracy, we value our rights and freedoms, you know, we value our also local tradition, we value our local traditions and we all get along. It was inevitable that the references to the Birka, we are not Birka, we show our faces. And also the reference to religion, it was inevitable that these were going to be picked on by the media. And these are actually the only ones that have made it to the English-speaking media. I don't think it'll do the party, the CDU-CSU, any lasting harm at the moment. They've deliberately chosen Thomas de Maizière to make this statement, which is quite appropriate because as Home Minister, the area of immigration and citizenship is squarely in his brief. But we also are pretty much certain that if there's another coalition in which the CDU-CSU would be involved, then he would lose his position as Home Minister. It would go to somebody else. So they're asking, deliberately asking someone who's perceived as a lame duck minister to make this statement, you know, to keep Angela Merkel as Chancellor candidate, to allow her to have some distance from this statement. And I think they're choosing to air it early so that we get this controversy out of the way. It's there are other reasons why they really have to make a statement on this issue at the moment. You'll be aware that the German Turks, those with dual nationality living in German, they were permitted to vote in the referendum for President Erdogan's referendum in Turkey, whether or not to give him additional powers. It was found that 63% of Germans who participated in that vote, German Turks, did in fact vote yes. They did vote to give Erdogan greater powers than he had already. And that has really shocked the general public. You know, people that they thought were integrated into their society, resident German Turks who they get along with on a day-to-day basis, they were shocked that democratic values seemed to mean so little to them that they're prepared to vote for authoritarianism in another country.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that divide does exist? I mean, in terms of, you know, German Turks supporting an authoritarian regime such as the one that's in Turkey at the moment?
That's an interesting question. I don't actually have any reliable evidence. But my guess would be that many Turks are quite happy to live under democratic freedoms in Germany, but they want to keep the door open for a more traditional society at home. Now, the reason why Turks keep dual citizenship rather than, you know, most of them do keep dual citizenship rather than naturalizing as Germans is because they lose their rights of inheritance if they lose their citizenship in Turkey. And so they keep hold of those rights. Many have a dream of going home eventually to Turkey. And I think what they associate as home is also more traditional values that no longer exist for them in their second life in Germany. So I don't think it's as quite as threatening as the German public perceive. You know, I think the German public is afraid that this means that there could be a big social divide between Turks and Germans on German soil. I don't think it means that. I think most Turks are quite happy with the rules of German life, but they might want to have a fallback for later on.
Well, Dr. Patricia Hogwood, a fascinating insight there. Many thanks for joining us on World in Focus.
You're welcome.
Tough questions are the most powerful weapon we have. As long as you have questions, we'll keep asking. Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. Last week saw the Pope meet with Muslim leaders in Cairo. These meetings come after a series of brutal and continuing acts of terror aimed at Christian communities across Egypt's cities. For more, here is Alexander South.
In an effort to mend ties with Islam, Pope Francis visited Cairo last Friday to meet with Muslim leaders in Egypt. The visit comes at a time where Egypt's ancient Coptic Christian community faces unprecedented pressure and attacks from so-called Islamic State. After a series of devastating attacks on Egypt's Coptic community, the most recent of which resulted in the deaths of 45 people killed in twin church bombings, is enough being done to protect Christian communities in the Middle East? To help answer these questions, I am now joined by John Pontifex, Head of Press and Information at Aid of a Church in Need UK, a charity organisation whose focus is to support suffering Christians in 140 countries around the world. John, firstly, what does it mean to be a Christian in the Middle East?
Well, of course, the Middle East is a situation which varies from country to country, and there's a danger there in applying a one-size-fits-all formula. But having travelled as I have in the likes of Syria and Iraq, and indeed in Egypt, you can see that there are common themes that emerge. And one of them is to say that they feel very much that though that country, that land, has been a place of Christianity since the beginnings of the faith, in many cases they don't feel very welcome at all. And so this means that in many parts of the world, but particularly in the Middle East, there is pressure indirectly and sometimes directly on Christians to leave. And that's the main sort of framework in which one should look at the situation of Christians in the Middle East. There is this pressure on them to either shut up or leave. And this pressure is mostly a sort of silent, insidious form through social pressure. But increasingly, there is the sporadic violence, which if you put all together, if you join the dots in terms of looking at the patterns of the violence, you can see how the response intended by those committing the crimes is to provoke a reaction of departure, of exodus. The visits that I've made to Iraq and Syria, you can see how people sometimes just feel they cannot continue with this pressure. They've got to get out. But there are other regions, notably Lebanon, parts of the more embattled countries, where the prospects are more positive, and where you can see there is an appetite among the Christians to make good the prospects of staying. It's Muslims who have been making that point about the fears they have with regard to Christians leaving the region.
So it's safe to say this isn't simply isolated to the Christian communities. Obviously, it has its effects on Muslim communities as well.
Well, that's right. And many Muslim communities, we know from what we've heard from our project partners and others, deeply regret the action taken by extremists. And my mind is turned, within the context of Egypt, back to the attacks on Christians that took place after President Morsi was forced out in a coup back in 2013. The Muslims prevented the extremist groups, the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafists, from attacking Christian regions, Christian towns, Christian communities, particularly in Upper Egypt. It was actually the Muslims who stopped those extremists from getting in. And this is a case worth bearing in mind when you have a temptation to look at one extremist group and say they're all like that. There's evidence, very strong evidence, to indicate that is just simply not the case, and to show that many of them are deeply aggrieved by the response taken by their so-called co-religionists.
Is there enough being done to protect Christian communities, such as Egypt's Coptic community, in Egypt and the Middle East? And do you think Christians feel protected by their faith leaders?
The concern is definitely there that they feel abandoned. They've told us that when we've had visits to them. Very often in their most difficult moments, they feel, who's listening to them? And the main problem here is that the media is not really interested in it. I mean, we have been very glad to hear the stories that have afflicted the Yazidi community, and that story needs to be told. Nobody would say for a moment that their plight is anything less than an abomination. But if we're shedding light on them, we also shed light on the suffering endured by the Christian community in the Middle East. And we need to remember that when ISIS carried out those wave of attacks and expanded its territory in from Mosul through to the Nineveh Plains in the summer of 2014, it was not just the Yazidis who were in the main line of fire. It was also the Christians. And they literally had to run into the night, out into the desert, and find their way to a new and very uncertain future. And if it weren't for Archbishop Bashar Warda in nearby Erbil, with support from people like ourselves, who knows what would have happened to those people? They were completely abandoned, and Aid to the Church in Need and many other organizations, but I have to say they're church organizations, not secular ones, not the UN, and certainly the government support, individual government support has potentially been not as good as it should have been. We can see that that help has actually kept these people alive. We have twin problems of political correctness and religious illiteracy, which are manifest problems in terms of really being able to assess the gravity of the crisis and to actually respond. Because there's a lack of will and there's a lack of understanding, you can see that there's a sense in which this whole suffering is a case of lost in translation.
What do visits, such as the Pope's visit last Friday, what do these visits mean to the Christian communities in the Middle East, and how beneficial are visits such as these?
Well, it's a long game that is being played here, in the sense that on the one hand, there's the media attention that it draws, but unfortunately that comes and goes. As soon as the media message is out, it becomes an old story, and that's just the way the media works. It's the longer game that's more important. And what Pope Francis has made as a priority, not just in this visit but in his whole pontificate, is the need to develop relations with the Muslim world. And he is setting a lot of store by the need to build up a sense of fellowship, a sense of shared experience and common cause with Muslim communities. And his relationship with the Muslim leaders, the various centers of Islam in Cairo, are key to building a consensus, which is about not only upholding a particular form of faith, but upholding the good that is faith. Because in the Western world, the notion of religious faith as a good is being seriously called into question.
Looking to the future, what can be done to safeguard and protect Middle Eastern communities in the Middle East?
That's a really important question. I must thank you for asking it, because frankly, that question is just not asked nearly enough. And that's part of the problem. In the Middle East, you have Christian communities, you have other faith communities who are in an absolutely desperate situation, what one can loosely describe as a do-or-die situation. Either you do something now, or you forget any prospect of that community remaining in that region. And I think here of the communities in Iraq, to which I've just alluded, who were forced out of Nineveh and Mosul and who took refuge in Erbil in Kurdish northern Iraq, but also of the various communities from Aleppo and other parts of Syria, which I have visited, and who are living a hand-to-mouth existence. There were, in fact, at least 1.5 million Christians in Syria, if not 2 million. And we're now seeing a community that's diminished by down to perhaps 500,000 or less. And the question is, what has become of those people? They are in a desperate, desperate need. And Christians aren't able to go to the UN camps very often because of segregation and because of the imposition of Islamic culture, which excludes non-Muslim communities. So these people are disappearing between the cracks because they're not registering at UN camps. And there is an emergency there that is on a mammoth scale to provide help. And governments, the UN, agencies, it needs a multilateral, multi-agency approach to provide emergency help for these communities, because their whole situation is turned upside down. And worst of all, they are just ignored by the West because they don't register on the in the UN camps and others. And the same is true with Erbil, where, again, the UN and others have not given the help that's needed. No government aid seems to have reached those Christians in Erbil. Not to my knowledge, I stand corrected possibly, but to my knowledge, no such help has been provided. And so there is an emergency that is far developed here. And the question is upon our conscience. Are we satisfied with the turn of events that is quickly leading to the disappearance of Christianity in its ancient heartland, with people with no means to survive? Or are we actually going to buck the trend and actually help them?
John Pontifex, Head of Press and Information at Aid to the Church in Need. Thank you. Alexander South, Sputnik News, signing off.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, US immigration officials have recommended that more than 50,000 people from Haiti temporarily living in the US should be deported back home, despite the country still recovering from a series of natural and man-made disasters. So will the move add even more misery to the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere? We'll have more on that in just a few minutes.
This is Radio Sputnik.
What are we to make of Trump's first 100 days in office? A president who entered the White House promising to roll back from years of disastrous foreign wars and military interventions ended this all-important initial period in power as one of the most hawkish and interventionist US presidents of modern times. And if this is the first 100 days, what can the world expect in the next 100 days of the Trump administration? Join me, John White, for the next episode of Hard Facts.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they send me back, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Brave New World.
For many of us, online shopping is already part of our ordinary lives. Why go out when you can sit on the sofa and order online? Shopping malls are apparently feeling the effect of this, and many are closing. Retail is evolving. To find out more, listen to Brave New World.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, US immigration officials have recommended that more than 50,000 Haitians temporarily living in the US should be deported home, despite the country still recovering from a series of natural and man-made disasters. So will the move add even more misery to the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere? And the UK Labour Party has taken the term grassroots campaigning very literally, with some campaign grass-cutting. Find out more at the end of the show. You are listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. Few populations have suffered as much from natural and man-made disasters like the people of Haiti. But just as the country makes tentative steps towards recovery, a recommendation by US immigration officials could add more strain on the Haitian infrastructure, as our reporter Mark Hurst has been finding out.
Over 50,000 Haitians living in the United States under so-called temporary protected status, TPS, should be deported back to Haiti under recommendations made by the US Citizenship and Immigration Services Agency. The Haitians fled to the US following the devastating earthquake that struck their country in 2010, killing over 150,000 people. Last October, Hurricane Matthew, the most devastating storm in decades, killed a further 1,000 Haitians. Haiti remains the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, with an estimated 3.2 million of its people, 30% of the entire total, suffering from food insecurity. A controversial UN peacekeeping mission has also resulted in misery for the Haitian population amid allegations of systematic sexual abuse and exploitation and a subsequent cholera outbreak started by Nepalese peacekeepers. The country has also been plagued by US interference for decades. Only a two-hour flight from the Florida coastline, Haiti's first elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, was overthrown in a CIA-backed coup in 1991. But could this latest proposal by US officials add further suffering to a country already blighted by a string of humanitarian crises? Earlier I spoke to Mark Schuller, Associate Professor of Anthropology and NGO Leadership and Development at the Northern Illinois University, and an expert on Haiti. Professor Schuller, Haiti may be recovering, but it's a long way from having a functioning infrastructure. What would the sudden arrival of over 50,000 Haitians from the United States do to the country's fragile economy and infrastructure?
Well, it's uncertain, which is why it's extending TPS would be a safer option. 50,000 people that are adapted to living in the United States, they're where would they be housed? Where would they find a job? Where would they be able to make a contribution? Do they have ties with the family that they still left behind? Many of them do. But the question would be, would the country be able to function? I mean, these are folks that are, the only thing that they did, quote unquote, wrong was to not have any official paperwork before they entered the United States. So these are ordinary folks that are trying to make a living and doing, feeling that they've to do so, it would be working in the United States. But the infrastructure, as you noted, is pretty tapped out. They're going to be able to get to certain places of the country. The rainstorm that happened a week ago wiped out a bridge in the south of Haiti in a town called Port Salut. So there are parts of the country that are literally inaccessible right now.
And how likely is it that the Haitian government will try and persuade Washington to hold off sending these people back until the country has made some additional steps towards a fuller recovery?
Well, that depends on whether the Haitian government feels that they owe the U.S. government anything in particular. Haiti has often been forced to do whatever the United States asks, given the role of U.S. policies of debt, given the loans, given the aid that we've conditioned, our government has conditioned. So very many times, sovereign countries don't, in the end, act like sovereign countries because they have too much obligation to the countries like the United States, as it is the case for many places in Africa when they have obligations to Europe, for example. Whether this particular government feels any kind of particular ability to negotiate with Donald Trump's administration, it's too soon for me to be able to tell. They're both too new of an administration to do anything specific, but Haiti has been suffering at the hands of the United States-led recovery efforts, United States-led economic development projects for Haiti. So there's there is reason to doubt whether the Haitian government will be able to stand up.
And the U.S. Immigration Agency seems to think that Haiti has made some considerable progress towards recovery. What evidence is there to support that claim?
Depends on how you define the word significant. I wrote a piece in the Huffington Post a week ago where we talk about the difference between Port-au-Prince and the rest of Haiti. Hurricane Matthew is still being felt on a day-to-day basis in much of the country where the crops have been destroyed. The trees are still bare in many cases or uprooted, certainly years from being able to grow fruit anymore. So to call Haiti without acknowledging that Haiti is not just Port-au-Prince that has made significant progress, I think that would be a problem. The other thing is, significant progress. This is the same administration when he was a candidate that was beating the drum of the lack of progress in Haiti after the earthquake at the hands of the Clintons. So this is about politics. This isn't about recovery. This isn't about actual facts. This is about alternative facts that they can be bent to mean whatever the administration wants it to mean. Is there evidence that in Port-au-Prince of Léogâne and Jacques Mel, who had been affected by the earthquake, are on the road to recovery? Yes, they're on the road to recovery, but I wouldn't call it significant progress at this point.
And you touched on it there, but Haiti remains important for the U.S. in geopolitical terms. Surely it's understood in Washington that they must take steps to avoid yet another humanitarian crisis in the country that may be caused by the forced deportation of these people. Is that well understood by both Democrats and Republicans, do you think?
Before this administration, I would have said it was the consensus position towards Haiti. I've interviewed folks in Washington, and they said the only consistent theme in U.S. foreign policy towards Haiti is keep them in Haiti. Don't have them come to the United States. So the TPS, temporary protected status, is an acknowledgement that people do sometimes make it to the United States extra-legally. George W. Bush, Clinton, and Obama, all the last three presidents were all clear on the subject. The current administration, it's not clear whether that's understood. I think the current administration lacks a huge amount of staff within the State Department to be able to draw these lessons that have been learned and to transmit the history of U.S. foreign policy to the current administration. And also, frankly, that the previous administrations do have more of a humanitarian approach to world politics, that there is some minimum standards of international law that must be followed. This administration is signaled that they not only not know about it, they don't care.
And the United Nations has had a presence in Haiti now for some years. It's proved very controversial, and they are due to wind up their mission in October. If the U.S. progresses with these plans to deport these Haitians, would a continued ongoing presence by the United Nations help that reintegration process?
How can a foreign military with speaking a dozen languages and not the national languages help in any kind of constructive way? Yes, there are some individuals that have made it to the place where they can facilitate contact, but that's not the point of a UN military mission. The point of the military mission was to stabilize the government after the U.S. policy of regime change in 2004. It's been renewed every year since for reasons unknown after two successful quote-unquote elections that had seen stable, peaceful transitions of power. So this is a classic case of a mission creep. Whether they're going to be able to help after they've been resoundingly critiqued in all segments of Haitian society for bringing cholera to the country for massive sexual violence and sexual abuse cases, I don't think that their presence is particularly helpful.
Professor Mark Schuller, I appreciate you talking to us today on World in Focus.
This is Radio Sputnik.
And finally, in the run-up to June's general election, the UK's Labour Party are reconnecting with grassroots campaigning, literally. Keen to get as many votes as possible, the former leader of the party, Ed Miliband, who is a candidate in the Doncaster North constituency in the upcoming snap general election, took a break from knocking on doors to cut a potential voter's grass. That's right, he spent some time cleaning up her lawn. His fellow campaigners took to Twitter to share pictures stating that they had secured the woman's vote. After his day spent gardening, we're awaiting news on his new campaign pledge for peas on earth. And that is all that we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget that you can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. In just a moment, we hand over to Washington DC for the Tom Hartman Show. And until tomorrow, from me, Carolyn Scott, and the whole team here at World in Focus, goodbye.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Brave New World.
For many of us, online shopping is already part of our ordinary lives. Why go out when you can sit on the sofa and order online? Shopping malls are apparently feeling the effect of this, and many are closing. Retail is evolving. To find out more, listen to Brave New World.
From June 1st to June 3rd, state officials and decision makers from top Russian and global companies are gathering in St. Petersburg for a one-of-a-kind event. St. Petersburg International Economic Forum 2017 is set to welcome over 12,000 participants from 133 countries. It featured discussions on most pressing issues of today, all under the aegis of its core theme, achieving a new balance on the global stage. Top government figures and leading experts from all around the world are meeting at the biggest platform for international discussion. For more details, head to www.forumsbb.com.
What are we to make of Trump's first 100 days in office? A president who entered the White House promising to roll back from years of disastrous foreign wars and military interventions ended this all-important initial period in power as one of the most hawkish and interventionist US presidents of modern times. And if this is the first 100 days, what can the world expect in the next 100 days of the Trump administration? Join me, John White, for the next episode of Hard Facts.